Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
The popular uprising against the regime of Hosni Mubarak in Egypt in recent weeks has captured the attention of the news media around the world. Often, the discussion of those events has drifted to the topic of the Muslim Brotherhood, focusing on what role that organization has played, or is playing, in the events in Egypt. Alas, given the nature of the news media, little attention is paid to the origins and nature of the Muslim Brotherhood, making it difficult to place current affairs into a broader historical context. Today on Research on Religion, we aim to correct for this media shortcoming by providing a more in-depth view of the Brotherhood. To accomplish this task, I am very pleased to be joined by Professor Nathan Brown, Professor of Political Science and International Affairs, and Director of the Institute for Middle East Studies at the George Washington University. Professor Brown is also a senior non-resident associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of numerous books on Middle Eastern politics, including The Rule of Law in the Arab World, Courts in Egypt and the Gulf, Palestinian Politics After the Oslo Accords, and the recently released Between Religion and Politics, published also by the Carnegie Endowment. He also has a forthcoming book with Cornell University Press titled Participation, Not Domination, Islamist Political Parties and Semi-Authoritarian Politics in the Arab World, expected to hit bookshelves in the fall. We'll link to all those books and others written by Professor Brown, as well as a number of articles that he has written on our website, so I encourage our listeners to check that out. Nathan, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me.
Before moving into today's topic, which is directly connected to contemporary events that are unfolding and moving quite rapidly, I should inform our readers that we are recording this podcast in the late afternoon on Monday, February 7th, 2011. As of right now, the Mubarak government is still in power in Cairo, last I checked on Google about 15 minutes ago. But one never knows what's going to happen during our taping or between that time that we record this audio and post it on our website, which will be about a week from its recording on February 14th. Nevertheless, our focus will largely be on the historical origins and impact of the Muslim Brotherhood, so that'll give us a better context in which to understand the current events as they unfold. And I should also note that the adorable host voice of Research on Religion is suffering a ever-worsening head and chest cold. And if you add to that fact that I've never been trained in Arabic, well, let's just put it this way. I'm going to be asking for your patience, understanding, and forgiveness when it comes to any of my pronunciations of Arabic words and names over the course of the next hour or so. All right. So, Nathan, take us back in time here. The Muslim Brotherhood is formed in the late 1920s, around 1928, I believe, roughly a decade after World War I and a few years after the abolition of the Ottoman Caliphate. Set the table for us here, if you could. What is going on politically, socially, and economically in Egypt and the Muslim Middle East more broadly at this time?
Sure. Well, I'd mention a few different contexts, one which you've already made reference to, a very changed international environment. There was a collapse of the Ottoman Empire in the aftermath of the First World War, and what that led to was an Egypt that was independent to a degree. It was the British had occupied Egypt back in towards the end of the 19th century, but had never detached it legally or juridically from the Ottoman Empire. They did so in World War I and made a brief effort to incorporate Egypt into the British Empire before a nationwide uprising stopped that. By the late 1920s, when the Muslim Brotherhood emerges, Egypt is largely independent except for foreign and defense affairs. The British still have the Suez Canal, and they have some other restrictions on Egyptian independence. So it's really the first time that Egypt has a political system that is largely but not completely independent of non-Egyptian rule.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that lingering British presence, by the way, that the Brotherhood takes aim against politically as time goes on. There's also a domestic political context as well. the 1920s and especially the 1930s was a time of increasing mobilization in Egyptian politics. Prior to that, politics had been the reserve of a narrow elite, landowners, a few highly educated professionals, high government officials, and so on. And what you see in the 1920s and 1930s with the spread of education and literacy is the entry of the middle class into politics, and the Muslim Brotherhood goes right into that constituency. And there's something a third thing going on as well, I would say, at sort of a social level, and perhaps at a religious level as well. The period of the late 19th and early 20th century saw an upsurge in missionary activity in Egypt. And some Muslim Egypt, Christian missionary activity,
Okay. This
wasn't necessarily aimed only at conversion. A lot of it was just aimed at doing social work and providing social services. Muslim Egyptians, however, got very concerned at this. And so there was a very strong push among them to do something to counter that missionary effort. And the Muslim Brotherhood, in a sense, plugged into that as well by saying, we don't have to have Christians from coming in from foreign countries to build orphanages, hospitals, and schools, and so on. We can start our own Egyptian movement, our own Muslim movement, in order to do the same thing.
That's really interesting. In some of my own work that I've looked at Latin America, you see similar trends around a similar time frame, that as transportation costs around the world are getting cheaper, you're getting a number of Christian missionaries from Europe, probably in Egypt, from Britain. That was a source of a lot of missionary work, but also United States and a few other places. We're really trying to expand outreach. And as you noted, a lot of these missionary organizations are providing social welfare services. And one could only expect, as I saw in Latin America, the Catholic Church reacting to this, one could expect that in Muslim Egypt as well.
Absolutely. Added to the to that angle, yeah, a lot of them were coming from Europe, especially UK and from the United States. But added to that was there was actually a sort of a legal political factor behind that.
Mm-hmm.
Up to this point, and actually until late 1930s, foreigners in Egypt essentially had extraterritorial status. They were governed by the law of their home country. So a missionary active in Egypt, for coming from the United States, would not have been governed by Egyptian law under basically an international convention known as the capitulation. And that only added to the sense of you could almost say, of kind of not simply a religious, but a cultural and a political invasion or alien presence.
You can imagine that. Now, the person who founded the Muslim Brotherhood, usually credited to Hassan al-Banna. And tell us a little bit about his background. Who was he? How is he inserted into this social political environment?
Well, he's a very interesting figure because although the Muslim Brotherhood is a religious movement, he wasn't a religiously trained figure. He did have some traditional religious education, but his own profession was as a school teacher, secular subjects. So he comes from sort of a religiously engaged, pious, and sort of an educated background, but he's not a religious scholar or a jurist of Islamic law or anything like that. He is essentially out there in the society, and he's influenced not simply by Christian missionaries, but by other sorts of organizations that he sees active in Egypt at the time. One of the little-known mottos of the Muslim Brotherhood, it is right there on their emblem, but nobody notices it, is what is in Arabic a single word, but which in English is two words, be prepared. And it seems to be directly influenced by the Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
What he looks at is, he sees these missionary activities, he sees the Boy Scouts, he also sees a host of Muslim organizations that are arising, sort of similar to what the Brotherhood would become, but a little bit restricted. They might be a youth movement, they might be a charitable group, and so on. He says, we've got to do something broader, we've got to do something comprehensive, we've got to do something that aims at reforming the individual, reforming the society. This is not about sort of withdrawing into yourself or building your own little community of saints. This is about making the individual, making the society better, and by better, they mean more Islamic. They're taking on Islamic themes in this. So it's a broad social, religious, charitable reform movement.
And so I would assume that that's the number of the activities that they're getting involved in here in the late 1920s. As you mentioned, it seems to be building a broader umbrella organization to bring a lot of different groups underneath them. Now, are they piggybacking on a number of different efforts, or is this basically a from-scratch type of organization?
Well, it's from scratch, but it's taking place in this environment in which all other kinds of organizations are sort of trying similar models. And the Muslim Brotherhood is the one that survives the longest. Mm-hmm. What the historians who've looked into this have come back with the conclusion that Hassan al-Banna's genius was not as a systematic thinker or as a somebody who came up with a comprehensive doctrine, but he was an organizational person. What he did was find a way not simply to inspire individuals and to create sort of small local movements, but to create a large organization that was based on a sort of a pyramid-type structure, at the base of which you had these small cells, a small group of friends who worked together, met together, studied together, acted together, and so on. So the Muslim Brotherhood was built on a series of tight personal binds was constructed eventually, first in sort of a local network, and then eventually on a national level.
What was the immediate reaction to what he was trying to do? Did he have to really slog through and convince people that this was something that they should join, or was there already an environment out there where people were saying, yeah, we need this, and let's jump into it?
Well, he's launching into a competitive environment, because there are some religious and in the 1930s, some non-religious groups that are basically trying to do the same thing.
Right.
So it's Egyptian society seems responsive to these kinds of calls at the time.
Mm-hmm. And how about the government? One would expect that a lot of these functions, especially in our modern contemporary era, that the government would take care of a lot of these concerns. But again, you know, this is the 1920s in Egypt, and how are they viewing this whole effort?
Well, in terms of kind of the competition for providing social services, that's not really so much of an issue. The Egyptian state didn't really get into providing social services beyond educational systems and a sort of few rudimentary efforts in public health, really until a couple decades later. So that isn't the issue. And in fact, what happens is a little bit different. There's a way in which you could see the Muslim Brotherhood get sucked into the political process rather than being seen as a rival to the state. This is at a time at which Egypt has a strong monarchy, but it also has a parliamentary system, and there is this kind of tug of war between political parties, and especially a leading political party, the one that led the uprising against the British back at the end of the First World War, and the monarchy. And the monarchy sometimes shuts the political system down, suspends the constitution, suspends parliament, or fixes elections and that sort of thing. And sometimes it allows for free elections and allows for the nationalist political party to win a majority. The Muslim Brotherhood, as it begins to mobilize people to build up a large constituency, looks attractive to various political actors. If you're playing a democratic game, as they sometimes are, there is a great constituency for you. You could win the allegiance of a large and sort of politically aware group of Egyptians by appealing to them. On the other hand, when sometimes the palace felt that what it needed was some kind of base of support if it wanted to move against the nationalist political party. So there is really sort of a competition for their affections. The Muslim Brotherhood is viewed in this period, basically the 1930s and into the 1940s, as probably a little bit too close to the palace, that is to say, a little bit too co-opted rather than as an opposition movement.
That's rather fascinating. What about the religious aspect? Now, one of the things that puzzles me with what you said earlier, that Hassan al-Banna is really more of a secularist, kind of the middle-class person that you're describing arising during this period of time. Where does the Muslim aspect come in on this? Does it come in rather early? Is he influenced by other thinkers around him? Where does the religious part come in?
Oh, sure, yeah. No, I mean, the Islamic dimension is central and essential from the very, very beginning.
Okay.
A lot of the sort of study groups they form are formed around religious subjects. In a sense, the Hassan al-Banna is saying to Egyptians, you know, you call yourself all Muslims, and that's great, but why don't you go and teach yourselves about your own religion? Why don't you read the Quran? Why don't you study religious texts? And so on. The leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna, and his successors have traditionally sent out a Friday message every week, a letter to all their members. Now you can read it on the website. Then they had different means of circulating it. But again, Friday being the Muslim day of prayer. And his speeches, if you read them or if you take a look at these regular letters, are just infused with religious vocabulary. Mm-hmm. It's a lay movement, in a sense. It is not connected with the religious establishment in any way. But it is deeply religious in all of its expressions.
And it's absolutely fascinating. You see that throughout history is that religious organizations actually provide ways to organize collective action fairly easily. And if you're spreading an organization, it's you want to plug into these types of organizations. One can obviously see it, that going on. Let's talk about how things progressed during the period of the monarchy and how things changed. Because by 1949, things must have changed, because that is the year that Hassan al-Banna is assassinated. What led up to this assassination and the relationship with the monarchy and different aspects of the government?
Sure. That's basically the story of the 1940s, how the Muslim Brotherhood sort of was transformed from a movement that was, if anything, seen too close to the establishment to being seen as one that was threatening it. What happened was that as the 1940s wore on, you have a heated political environment in Egypt. It's overheated because the British still haven't left. In the 1940s, during World War II, they actually stepped up their interventions in Egyptian politics, and they still had troops in the Suez Canal zone. And the nationalist movement kept on calling for complete and total independence of Egypt, but didn't seem to be able to provide it. Mm. The Egyptian government tried everything. Actually, they went directly to the Security Council in 1946. Said, "You've got to get the British out of Egypt. You know, we should be an independent country." And we would. They did have a treaty, but they wanted to renegotiate that treaty so that the British wouldn't be able to station troops in the country and so on. The Muslim Brotherhood, being kind of this active, engaged organization, said, "Okay, well, we'll let the diplomats and the government worry about it on that front. We will train people. We will train people in order to defend Egypt and to defend Islam." And they basically started launching their own paramilitary organization. At the same time, what became the Arab-Israeli conflict is heating up in neighboring Palestine, then a British mandatory territory, and a contest between the Zionist movement trying to build a Jewish homeland and an Arab and Palestinian population, which was largely Muslim. As early as the 1930s, the Brotherhood took this up and said, "This is a Muslim cause." Mm. By the 1940s, they're collecting donations, and then they're training people for it. The Brotherhood wasn't the only organization getting involved in sort of paramilitary and guerrilla activities during this period, but it's one that they have. Their sets of activities were probably more challenging because they were such a large movement. And to this day, they haven't lived down the reputation. They attacked British troops in the Canal Zone. They sent fighters to Palestine. And there were some from the organization who undertook some urban terrorism in Cairo, bombing movie houses and that sort of thing. The connection with the movement as a whole was never quite clear. And the Brotherhood said, essentially, these are rogue elements. We don't have complete control over them. We have nothing to do with this. Nobody really believed them, mm-hmm. and this kind of paramilitary organization, what they called the special apparatus, seemed to be a little sort of empire within the empire of the Muslim Brotherhood that wasn't completely under control.
So this never got officially endorsed by Hassan al-Banna at this time.
He was definitely behind it. Exactly how much he had control over it is something that people debate to this day, and how much it was actually implementing his wishes. Mm-hmm. But it sure made the government nervous, and in the Palestine War, which Egypt entered in 1948, they decided to ban the organization. The prime minister who banned the organization was assassinated, presumably by a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it seems that at this point, the Egyptian police went into action and assassinated Hassan al-Banna in retaliation in 1949.
And if I remember that, they had called him to a special meeting to negotiate some things, and he just waited and waited and eventually was shot. Is that how it occurred?
Yes. And again, this is widely attributed to the Egyptian police, exactly whose instructions they were acting on behalf. is not quite clear. People attribute it now to the palace.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the 1950s, we start to see a significant change occurring in Egypt with the rise of Gamal Abdel Nasser as president. He overthrows the previous monarchy and starts to adopt what you would be considered a more aggressive nationalist, anti-imperialist, and some would even say a socialist or modernizing tone to his regime. What politically, what is going on there between the monarchy and Nasser, and then how does this affect the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, at first there's kind of, I would say, a combination of flirtation and rivalry, because what the Brotherhood sees in these in the officers who overthrow the regime is the sort of people who pass through the Brotherhood. Some of the officers had been members of the Brotherhood, like or close to it. Anwar Sadat, Nasser's eventual successor, was seen as very pious, very religious himself, and a Brotherhood supporter within within the regime. So the Brotherhood looks to these people and says, "Wait a second, is this us, or are these our friends?" And the free officers take a look at the Brotherhood and said, "You know, this could be a potential ally." And in fact, for the first year or so, there's a kind of a close relationship between them, still kind of a guarded one. But when the free officers, for instance, move to take control of the political system, they ban all existing political parties. The Brotherhood isn't a party, so they get to continue operating. So it looks like they're a little bit favored. At one point, they're even offered a cabinet position, which they decide to turn down. But as time goes on, and as this new military or regime with military origins consolidates itself, it sees the Brotherhood increasingly as a potential rival, and they're very nervous again about what seems to be the continued existence of this special apparatus, this paramilitary group within the Brotherhood.
And this is largely coming from the government at the time, that they're becoming increasingly suspicious of the Brotherhood.
Exactly, and the Brotherhood is getting more and more disappointed with the with this new government. Thinking, you know, we thought they may be coming in to move Egypt in a little bit more Islamic direction, and they seem to be moving against us. They're not the friends we thought they were.
And so, to what extent did the religious element play an important wedge issue between these two groups at the time? Because Nasser is really known as being somebody who did not promote Islam or was not seen as and very pious. He instead took a more third way socialist secular route, modernizing eras. This become a big concern for the Muslim Brotherhood?
Not really, actually. I mean, it is an issue. The Brotherhood wants to move Egypt in an Islamic direction. That's absolutely the case. But Nasser is not necessarily seen as an enemy of religious forces. He himself actually has a reputation of being personally religious, but he just doesn't draw on it in his sort of public presentation and his speeches and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Egypt is, you know, a society, you know, that is deeply religious, and so the free officers are hardly going to, they would be taking on a big task if they decided to secularize the society. Nobody's arguing for secularism, and the free officers, again, aren't all that religious in kind of their political orientations, but they're not trying to marginalize religion in Egyptian life by any means.
So they're not really taking the path that Ataturk took in Turkey a decade or two earlier to that?
Not at all. They're in a sense, in the public presentation, not hostile to role for religion in public life, not in favor of it, just kind of silent on the issue. And the Brotherhood at that point was led by a figure who was probably happy with that. When Hassan al-Banna was assassinated, they realized they had a problem on their hands. And so what they did was they brought in a very respected judge who was himself religious but hadn't been really with the organization. And so he was kind of an establishment figure, kind of very quiet and seen as very moderate presence within Egyptian public life. And so he leads a Brotherhood that looks like it might be able to deal with this regime. But you have other elements within the Brotherhood who are saying, you can't trust this regime. They're going to come and crush us. And eventually the Brotherhood, the regime moves to suppress the Brotherhood and suppress it fairly harshly, and a member of the Brotherhood is accused of trying to assassinate Abdel Nasser in 1954. It's not clear to this day exactly what happened, whether this was a rogue operation, whether it was the regime. Some people within the Brotherhood claim, perhaps a bit conspiratorial, that this was all set up by the regime. It was just a ploy. But for whatever actually happened, the regime, Nasser was not hurt, but he blamed the Brotherhood for attempting to kill him, and he set up a series of special courts and special tribunals that basically decimated the top leadership, actually executed a few leaders, drove others into exile, and rounded up large numbers of members of the Brotherhood and threw them into jail.
And so this is occurring in the mid-1950s to through the 1960s. Nasser himself dies in early 1970s. So during the 1960s, what is occurring with the Brotherhood and the regime? Are they being forced underground? Are they growing as a movement? Are they shrinking? What's happening here in the 60s?
They're basically shrinking. I mean, these are very, very tough times, the 1950s, really until the 1970s for the Brotherhood. There are some times when the regime lets up a little bit, sees this as a crushed movement, and sometimes they come under pressure from other countries, especially in the Arab world, to say, you know, go easier on these people. But it's during this period that some thinkers within the Brotherhood begin to develop much more radical ideas about what how to act, how to behave towards the government, what being a member of the Brotherhood means in political terms. This is a period, for instance, in which Said Qutb, who was one of the more influential intellectual leaders within the Brotherhood, begins to develop thoughts in a very radical direction.
And is this where religion or religious thought or theology become more infused in the movement during this period of time? Because one could imagine that the organization is becoming very disillusioned with the more secular path that Nasser is taking.
It's always very, very religious, and it always sort of thinks in religious terms. This is when it starts getting, I think, a little bit more specifically political. I mean, this is always a broadly engaged movement, and it never gave up politics. But you begin to hear arguments, even in the 1950s, that says, okay, Islam is not simply a religion, it is a way of life, and if it's a way of life, that means that there's an Islamic way to do things and a non-Islamic way to do things. That has legal implications. A government that does not implement Islamic law is not really properly an Islamic government, and any law that it passes that is at variance with Islamic law is invalid. And by the 1960s, Said Qutb is basically pushing this even farther to say that the Egyptian political system and the Egyptian society as a whole is no longer really an Islamic society because it is not governed in accordance with Islamic legal principles.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what they're doing is no longer saying to the political leaders of the country, you're mistaken. They're beginning to say to the political leaders of the country, you're heading a system that is at odds with, in an adversarial relationship with, that is an enemy of Islam.
Yeah, they're illegitimate in terms of the society in that regard. So in 1970, Nasser dies, and his successor, Anwar Sadat, starts to take a different stand toward the Brotherhood. And if I'm correct, he released some of the members that had been held in prison for some time there. And one of the things you had mentioned earlier is that many in the Muslim Brotherhood actually viewed Sadat as an ally, as somebody who seemed to be a very pious individual. So what happens in the relationship when Nasser passes from the scene and the torch passes to Sadat?
Well, several things. In the 1970s, there is sort of a slight warming in that relationship. First, people in the Brotherhood looked at Sadat and said, hey, we knew this guy. He was one of us once. And Sadat himself presents a far more a religious image than Nasser did. Nasser, again, had the reputation of being personally religious, but he didn't wear his religion on his sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Sadat made an awful lot of his religious nature and sort of presented himself as the religious president of Egypt. And he's also presiding over a liberalization of the Egyptian political system. He begins by dismantling sort of pockets of the regime that Nasser built, which aren't controlled by him. So it looks at first to be a little bit of an opportunistic move on his part to move against his rivals and call this liberalization. by the middle of the decade, he's actually opening up Egyptian political life a little bit more. And he begins to let these people out of jail, where they've been held for a long time, tortured. He lets some of them who fled overseas come back. There are some who've made fortunes in the Gulf and Saudi Arabia. He says, you know, come on back, bring your money home, invest in Egypt. And at this point, the Brotherhood is not quite sure what to make of him. They say, this is the same regime that did all these things to us. But on the other hand, they're opening up to us a little bit. And the Brotherhood sort of slowly begins to try to reemerge and to rebuild its organization, keeping a fairly wary eye on Sadat, but not really regarding him as the same kind of enemy that they regarded Nasser.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of that as well, before we get into the presidency of Hosni Mubarak, actually, let's continue on here with the 1970s, because something happens in the 70s that starts to really sour the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Sadat here in the late 70s. What was that?
Well, there's a complicated series of events. I mean, and Sadat shows signs of not really being able to decide what to do with the Brotherhood. On the one hand, the Brotherhood is very useful. You know, he can sort of propagate his religious image. Something else is happening too, and that is that on Egyptian college campuses, you have an upsurge of Islamic activism, some of which is actually fairly radical. And the Brotherhood at this point is dominated by much tamer religious figures. So when the older leaders of the Brotherhood meet up with these younger college students, they basically have a way of sort of calming them down and integrating into the system. So in those kinds of ways, the Brotherhood was useful. But Sadat's doing other things that the Brotherhood doesn't like. One is the peace treaty with Israel, which they reject. Another is that he's not simply liberalizing the political system, he's liberalizing the economic system, and the Brotherhood is a little bit uncomfortable. They're not socialist by any means, but they're uncomfortable a little bit with the kind of consumer society that they see that Sadat is bringing, and they see a close relationship with the United States. The Brotherhood is not friendly to the Soviet Union by any means, but they're not really comfortable with the idea that Egypt is part of sort of an American-sponsored world order. So there's tension in that relationship. The Brotherhood now claims that essentially what Sadat did was to offer them a deal, said, go ahead and rebuild your organization, build your schools, build your orphanages, build your social clubs and networks, whatever, just stay out of politics. And as long as you do that, I'll let you operate however you like. In a sense, you can be useful to me in kind of siphoning off the more people from the more radical groups.
Mm-hmm.
The Brotherhood says it rejected that deal. It always regarded its mission as comprehensive. It certainly wants to be socially engaged, but it wants to be politically engaged as well. So by the late 1970s, there's real tension. Most of the real active religious opposition to Sadat came not from the Brotherhood, but from radical groups that had essentially taken the ideas of Saeed Qutb and pushed them out to their logical conclusion. The Brotherhood at this point is trying to repudiate some of Qutb's, the radical implications of Qutb's ideas. It's trying to kind of tame that legacy. It's trying to come up with the idea that it's un-Islamic to call for one Muslim to call another Muslim, you know, an apostate and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the more radical movements are going in a different direction. And by 1981, one of them actually assassinates Sadat. In this general crackdown of Islamic movements that precedes and follows that, the Muslim Brotherhood is targeted as well by an Egyptian regime that's no longer quite so permissive when it comes to Islamic opposition.
And so that the assassination of Sadat in 1981 is not in essence, or is not at all associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, but a different radical group. But nonetheless, they're caught up in the net that is cast over all these groups, right?
Absolutely. It's done by a group that, in a sense, has said the Muslim Brotherhood's way is just too gradual, too willing to make compromise. They've sold out.
Mm-hmm. And I can only imagine then, as we start here into the early 1980s, when Hosni Mubarak follows Anwar Sadat as president of Egypt, that relations between the Muslim Brotherhood and his regime are going to be rather soured. Before we get to that, though, and we started talking a little bit about the issue of the Palestinian question and how some in the Muslim Brotherhood and other radical groups start becoming disillusioned with the Camp David Accords and such. The Muslim Brotherhood actually has a fairly strong international presence beyond Egypt. Tell us a little bit about that. And that dates back to its most early years, if I'm correct.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is kind of a complicated issue because exactly what the Brotherhood ties with its, or the ties among the various Brotherhood organizations is sometimes a matter of controversy. But what happens is that people in other Arab countries, first in the Arab world, eventually elsewhere, but first in the Arab world, begin to look at the Muslim Brotherhood, and some people decide that they want to build an organization like that in their own country. Some travel to meet Hassan al-Banna and sort of get his blessing to set up a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in their own country.
And this is as early as the late 20s, early 30s.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. And so they're setting up branches in Syria, for instance, among the Palestinians in Jordan, and so on. And then when the NAS, and this happens basically 30s and 40s, mm-hmm. 1950s, when the regime cracks down on the Brotherhood, a lot of them flee overseas. And some of them go to countries which are friendlier to them and let them operate. And at the same time, this is a period of great state building in many Arab countries. They're looking for teachers, they're looking for qualified personnel, and there's a large group of people in Egypt who are sort of middle class, have the requisite skills. They may be Brotherhood affiliated, and Egypt is not such a comfortable place anymore. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that those sorts of people begin to go out of Egypt. Some of these Arab countries send people to Egyptian college campuses where the Brotherhood has been active. Yasser Arafat, for instance, a Palestinian student, gets educated at Cairo University, where he gets involved with the local Brotherhood chapter. Mm-hmm. So in these kinds of ways, you have Brotherhood chapters being set up throughout much of the Arab world. Those organizations really are sort of country-specific. All the various branches of the Brotherhood recognize each other, and there is some sort of loose international network linking them. But they basically, the Brotherhood makes a decision early on that says, you know, conditions in our various countries are so different that we will allow each local leadership to do whatever they see is best. They're the ones who are on the scene. They have the local knowledge necessary to decide how to apply this general model in a specific setting.
Yeah, that's where I wanted to ask you about, because this fascinates me. During the Nasser regime, Nasser was actually very adamant about trying to promote a pan-Arab nationalism, the third way, and become the leader of this organization. And at the same time, you have the Muslim Brotherhood reaching out. It's obviously a network where you have Egyptians in many other countries, and to what extent the organization was tightly linked back to Egypt or not, I guess, would vary by countries. But was there some degree of tension between the Muslim Brotherhood and this pan-Arab nationalism movement that Nasser was promoting in the 50s?
Yes, but we shouldn't overstate it. I mean, the pan-Arabism that Nasser was promoting was definitely national. It was Arab mm-hmm. in orientation. It wasn't specifically Islamic. Egypt is active on the Islamic scene, of course, but it's primarily nationalist. And there are some within the Brotherhood who say, This is not the Muslim way. Muslims do not know differences among nations. If you're in the community of Islam, you're in the community of Islam. Said Qutb in particular, who's developing radical directions, says, you know, one of the problems is we've got all these foreign ideologies. We've got nationalism. We've got socialism. We've got Marxism, and so forth and so on. And the really important question is, are you running your life and your society on an Islamic model or not? So there certainly is some tension between the Nasserist approach, which is nationalist, and the Brotherhood approach, which is religious in inspiration. But I would say for much of the Brotherhood, on an ideological level, they'd probably be closer to Said Qutb, but they still think primarily in local terms. The Egyptian Brotherhood supports the Palestine cause. It supports other chapters of the Brotherhood elsewhere. But their political horizons are basically restricted to Egypt. And that's the case with most of the Brotherhood organizations that form.
Yeah, that's the question I was going to ask. it being in some respects, a pan-Islamic movement or focusing on Islam, was it able to cross boundaries between Sunni and Shiite Islam at all?
No, not at all.
Okay.
The Brotherhood is exclusively a Sunni organization. There are many within the Brotherhood who have this kind of broad and expansive view towards the Islamic world. So they sometimes, many members of the Brotherhood are more hostile, I would say, to anti-Shi propaganda than others. They say, "Look, we're all Muslims. We're not Shia. But we recognize the Shia as legitimate Muslims." So they might be a little bit more, you could say, ecumenical in their approach at times. Not all of them are. But the Brotherhood itself is strictly a Sunni organization.
And what areas of the world has the Muslim Brotherhood beyond Egypt really shown some great strength? And the reason I'm asking this is because when we start talking about contemporary times here and what is going on in Egypt right now, I'm wondering to what extent that what happens in Egypt will be inspirational for other organizations or of the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the world. So where are they the strongest elsewhere in the world outside of Egypt?
Well, Hamas, the Palestinian movement, sees itself as definitely a Muslim Brotherhood movement, and they're the government right now in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
They've got strong chapters in Jordan, I would say in Kuwait. They've got movements that are active in Iraq, Indonesia, Pakistan, and elsewhere. Their strongest movements are in the Arab world, but they are present throughout the Muslim world.
And how are relations between governments and these Muslim Brotherhood movements in other parts? Is Indonesia saying, "Hey, this is great," or are they cracking down on them? What about Pakistan?
It really depends on the country. I mean, there are some which have said, Syria, for instance, membership in the Muslim Brotherhood is considered a capital offense. Others, for instance, Kuwait, they serve in the parliament. They've held cabinet ministries. There is a legal political party that's associated with the Brotherhood. When the Brotherhood is sort of one political player among many, and when the system is it doesn't have to be fully democratic, but at least if it's a little bit pluralist, then the government usually will allow some role for the Brotherhood. In other cases, when they're suspicious of any kind of independent political organization, or in which the Brotherhood looks like it's going to be too powerful, in those kinds of situations, governments crack down on the Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm. And again, you'd mentioned that each of these movements really seems to have a fair degree of autonomy from one another. They tend to be much more focused on local conditions and such. But is there any type of international network that information flows between them? Are there regularized meetings of members of the Muslim Brotherhood at all?
Absolutely. I mean, there is an international organization, that says, you know, either if you're a member of this international organization, you're a Brotherhood organization, or you're not. It's always headed by an Egyptian. My evidence that it's not all that powerful an organization there's one time I was in Kuwait with some leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood in Kuwait, and one of them turns to me and says, "Nathan, what do you think of the new general guide of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood?" Now, this is the general guide of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is also the head of the international organization. This guy was theoretically their leader. So they said, "Nathan, what do you think of him?" And I said, and I didn't quite hear the question, I said, "Who?" And then they said, and then one of them turned to the other and said, "What's his name again?" And the person said, "I don't remember." This is supposed to be their leader.
Right.
And in fact, later I had a conversation with one of them, and he said, "The problem is this. The Egyptians came up with this model, but they monopolize the international organization. The position of the Egyptian movement, it comes under a lot of pressure from their government. The head of the movement can't even travel. We're happy to try to coordinate with them, but this is not really the sort of organization that we think can operate all that effectively on an international level."
Yeah. Is there any resentment to any extent that each chapter has to have an Egyptian representative present or a guide or something?
Yes, you certainly had this. You had some echo of this a couple of years ago when the general guide of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood retired. and they had to pick a successor. Now, the successor would be the head of the international organization as well. And people in the international organization said, wait a second, this is not just an Egyptian decision. We have to be at least consulted in the matter. So they did have some kind of consultation session, but there was some evidence of grumbling that essentially Egyptians are picking our own leader for us.
So let's take this now, and this is really good to set the table for the international impact of what is going on in Egypt might have now. But so let's take it back again, and we're going to re-roll the calendar to the early 1980s in Mubarak. You had Sadat's assassination in 1981. Mubarak looks at these radical Islamic groups and anybody smacking of any opposition to him, and you know, basically cast a wide net to clamp down on these organizations. What happens through the 1980s and 1990s in terms of the relationship between Mubarak and the Muslim Brotherhood that could inform us about what is going on today?
Well, the interesting thing is the story that you just told is basically true, but the 1980s are a bit of an exception.
Mm-hmm.
Mubarak comes in, and you know, he's an Air Force commander. He's a military man, very security-oriented by background. But he looks and he says essentially that Sadat got us into a mess. He basically alienated every single political and social force in the country. So he launched a liberalization program. It didn't go very far, but it allowed for, he basically released all the people that Sadat had arrested, and he allowed the Brotherhood to reemerge. He never allowed them to gain legal status again. But through most of the 1980s, the Brotherhood is allowed to kind of rebuild its organization. It's actually even allowed to run people for parliament. The electoral system is at first designed to only allow party members to run, but so the Brotherhood is able to place people on the slates of other political parties, and Mubarak doesn't stop that. So you have members of the Muslim Brotherhood active in parliament. And so it looks like what Mubarak is trying to do is to bifurcate the Islamic opposition to say, you know, I don't like any of these people, but if you are of the tame Brotherhood variety and you agree to play by the rules, then I'll tolerate you. The minute you start doubting with these radical ideas and radical actions, I will use the full repressive apparatus available to me, administrative detention, torture, and so forth and so on. By 1987, when Mubarak's first term is over, the Brotherhood actually endorsed him for re-election mm-hmm. as a result of this. But by the late 1980s, there is the more radical groups are... The relationship with the government is extremely tense, and it results in essentially an insurrection by the radical groups, and the Mubarak regime comes down hard, and it changes. It seems to change his mind about the Brotherhood. Instead of saying we'll use you as a way of kind of siphoning off the support for the radicals, we see you as a transmission belt to the radicals. People come into the Brotherhood, and then they find it too inactive, so they graduate onto the more radical groups. We're not exempting you. You're the one who basically provided the intellectual ideas. You're the ones who fostered Said Qutb, and that's who these people are all reading. So the Brotherhood found itself under very harsh repression from Mubarak in the 1990s. Never, however, completely shut down. They continued to operate. They continued to have the ability to run people for parliament, and they continued to have some kind of publication, some kind of, you know, you can actually go to Brotherhood headquarters in Cairo and meet the officials of the organization and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So they never were completely shut down. They were just very heavily harassed.
And so does this continue on into the first decade of the 21st century here?
Absolutely. But what happens in the 21st century is that the Brotherhood begins to, you know, after a couple of decades of political experience, begins to learn how to play the political game much more effectively. And so they in the 2005 parliamentary election, they basically found a way to launch probably the most impressive opposition campaign in Egyptian parliamentary history and wound up with one-fifth of the seats in the Egyptian parliament.
So that brings us up to our present time. Today, as you look on the streets of Cairo, there's protests erupting against Mubarak. How did that come about, and what role has the Muslim Brotherhood played in this unrest?
Well, it came about having absolutely nothing to do with the Brotherhood. These were you have had, since the middle of the decade, essentially, a variety of protest movements, you know, youth groups that are trying to galvanize Egyptians into action, some labor movements that have said the Egyptian state is failing to provide for its citizens, even large numbers of government employees who say we're not getting our salaries properly and we're going to go and demonstrate in front of the parliament and so on. There's been sort of a steady hum in Egyptian society of kind of protest movements.
And a lot of this isn't necessarily religiously motivated. It's just, as you mentioned, hey, where's my paycheck? It's kind of dwindling away.
Most of it has absolutely nothing to do with religion. It's bread and butter, or it's a political expression, or that sort of thing. It's a political and an economic agenda, not a religious agenda. Now, the Brotherhood looks at this and thinks maybe we can profit from it, maybe not, but we have to be very, very careful. I remember talking to a Brotherhood activist, a Brotherhood leader, this was in the middle of the decade, and I asked him, why is it when these groups try and demonstrate that you don't join them? They always complain, the Brotherhood doesn't turn out for our demonstrations. And he said, look, if they demonstrate and the regime decides to come down hard on them, they get beaten up. If we pulled our people out, they'd get sent to jail for 10 years. We can't afford this. Mm-hmm. We have to watch out for the health of the organization as a whole. And in the last couple years, what happened was that those people in the Brotherhood who were really oriented towards saying, let's protect the organization, we've got much more to do than politics, we've got some social work, we've got to make sure that we bequeath this Brotherhood movement to the next generation. We've got to be a little bit less threatening to the regime. Let's just calm things down a little. Mm-hmm. Those people basically got control of the organization. The ones who were saying, let's invest in parliament, let's invest in politics, let's make coalitions with other opposition movements, those people got shunted aside. When this wave of demonstrations started in January, the politicians within the Brotherhood were on the outs. And so the Brotherhood just kind of held back and didn't even have kind of the skills necessary to negotiate, to talk to the press, to form coalitions, and to negotiate common stances with other opposition movements. It took them, I mean, these protests started on Tuesday, it really took them until Friday to say, we want to be on the right side of this. So they basically stood aloof and didn't really call out their own people for several days.
And one could imagine, too, in terms of the chaos that is sweeping in the streets, many people are looking around and saying, okay, if Mubarak goes, who then? What next? And it would seem to me that the Muslim Brotherhood is probably the best organized group and probably the most trusted of the groups that are potential rulers in that for Egypt next, that it would make them an obvious candidate to involve themselves in negotiations now, would it not?
Yes, but we shouldn't exaggerate that.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is what we've got right now is a whole host of organizations that without the help or guidance of the Brotherhood have managed to bring this regime to its knees. And so and they're the ones who are kind of the powerful political force. What they don't have, which the Brotherhood does have, is a very clear leadership. This is a very diffuse movement with 1,000 different chiefs. And
the protest movement, you're saying, the one in the streets now.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so the Brotherhood is definitely going to play a role. But in addition, this protest movement has made very clear that they want regime change. Mm-hmm. The Brotherhood says they'd like it too, but on the other hand, they say we're not worried about just tomorrow, we're worried about the next generation. We want to preserve this organization. So that yesterday, for instance, when Omar Suleiman, the vice president, called members of various opposition organizations to negotiate, most of them stayed away. The Brotherhood said, we need to show up.
I should just mention that it would be February 6th that we're talking about here.
Absolutely, yes. Okay. This is February 6th on Sunday. There was an attempt, basically, by the regime to have his vice president play as good cop. He was going to sit down with the opposition. The only meaningful opposition group that really sat down with him was the Brotherhood. And the reason they did so, they were subject to an awful lot of criticism from the rest of the opposition, even from their own ranks for having done so. But the reason they did so is they said, you know, the last thing we want to do right now is to create a permanent enemy out of this regime. We want some kind of change. We want some kind of reform. But we have paid a very, very heavy price in the 1950s and 1960s, and we don't want to go back to those days.
Right. Yeah, so one can kind of understand how they've suffered in the past and are taking a much more reform-minded approach to all of this. But how does that play in the media? Because if you take a look at various media outlets here in the United States, you don't necessarily get that picture. You don't see the fragmentation. A lot of this, people say, well, this is the Muslim Brotherhood that is really motivating this. But as you point out, it's really not. They might be a few steps behind the protest here. And how are other governments in the Arab world looking at this as well? Do they see the Muslim Brotherhood becoming involved in this? And one could imagine in Syria, the government is saying, whoa, this is not good. We can't have this kind of stuff here. Is there a sense that the Muslim Brotherhood in different countries might be paying a price for what is going on in Egypt?
Other governments within the region are definitely nervous. And essentially what has happened is, I mean, there's a wide gulf in most Arab countries between the regime and between the society. But resistance, doing anything about it in most of these places seems futile. After the events in Tunis, after the events in Egypt, all of a sudden the possibility of forcing political reform seems an awful lot more real. Mm-hmm. But in most of the Arab world, this is not seen as the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood is not the center of attention. It's a center of attention, I think, in the U.S. and the West, primarily after 9/11. I mean, the idea of certain forms of political Islam being scary is one that has great resonance here. In most of the rest of the Arab world, this is kind of seen by in the societies as sort of a little bit of a, I would say, a Tiananmen moment, or perhaps a 1989 Eastern Europe moment. This is an entire society rising up against a repressive government. There may be some oversimplification to that, but the Muslim Brotherhood is just seen as one actor among many. It's certainly not dominating the story in the Arab world.
And again, now you're a social scientist, and as I'm a social scientist too, we always try to avoid prognostications because we oftentimes can be proved wrong in that. But I'm going to throw that caution to the wind there and ask you, what are your thoughts about what is transpiring in the Middle East now with relation to Egypt, and you know, what role do you think the Muslim Brotherhood is going to play in this transformation, if any, over the next several years?
Well, you're right about the difficulty of prognostication. The fact is, we're in a situation that nobody would have anticipated in this form even a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, it's very, very hard to say. Is this the dawn of a new era in Arab politics? At this point, I think that's a possibility. I think the most likely outcome right now in Egypt is a more liberalized and reconfigured version of the same regime. I think the regime may be able to sort of pull this one out and diffuse the protest movement with simply some mild concessions. Mm-hmm. If that's the case, one of those concessions might be a little bit more liberalized political environment, and that's one where the Brotherhood would actually probably do okay. They'd be able to reemerge. They're not going to be running the country, but they'd be able to reemerge and rebuild their organization after the repression of the last few years. If we see, however, something a little bit more deeply rooted change, if we see something more closely akin to regime change, the Brotherhood again will probably do okay, but there have been so many other political actors that have just entered the arena, these youth groups, labor movements, and so on. I think the Brotherhood has no hope of dominating. And in fact, they say that's not what they want. What they want, they say, is to be one player among many. And I think that what we have to recognize is that they don't really have the capability right now to be much else.
Well, this is something that we're definitely going to have to keep our eyes on, and I've enjoyed our visit today with you, and we'll be watching for your book that's coming out here in the fall, which is Participation, Not Domination, Islamist Political Parties and Semi-Authoritarian Politics in the Arab World. And when that comes out in the fall, I think we're going to have you back on and take a reassessment of what has actually been happening over here. So, Nathan, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.